Hello, and welcome to this pre-recorded session for Millennial 2018. And unfortunately, my camera has run out of battery power and I have a technical problem with that. So I do apologize, but I'm going to be avatar only in this hangout. But luckily, our guest does have video, and it is the illustrious, much loved Jared Taylor. Welcome, Jared, to Millennial 2018.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on your program.
Oh, thank you. And we're going to speak about a book by Robert Plomin. Plomin. And it's, well, first of all, what is the need for this book? Let's say that. We should say that it's called Blueprint, and it's about environment versus genes. So what is the need for this book first?
The need for it is a very serious one, namely because for, I would say the past 50 years, the consensus among the bien-pensant, the people who wish to be taken seriously and to be considered virtuous, have insisted that genes are far less important than environment in forming who we are. This is really the basis of really the last half century in social policy. The idea being, of course, that if we have inequalities in societies, they are the consequence of unfair environments. As a result, the theory is that by pouring money into programs to equalize environments, then we can equalize outcomes. And this effort has been, at least in the United States, and also to some extent in Britain as well, directed towards equalizing outcomes for people of different races. And the importance of this book is that it gathers together in one place all of the latest findings that show just how important DNA is, and that environmental influences, to the extent that they are measurable, are very, very difficult to change. And the book, if I may introduce it to your viewers and listeners, it's called Blueprint. And the subtitle is How DNA Makes Us Who We Are. And it's written by a Yank by the name of Robert Plomin, who has made his career in Britain. And he really is a very careful scientist and a good teacher. And this book, I think, is a very, very important one in blowing up some of the current myths about how society works and what causes inequality.
Right. Okay. And something you said that genetic effects are actually very difficult to override. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because that's an that it not only are they there, but actually they're very difficult to override by environment.
Yes. For a long time, it has been possible to use twin studies to determine how much of who we are is genetic and how much is environmental. The most effective twin studies, of course, are of those rare twin pairs which have been given up for adoption at birth, separated and reared in different households. There have been several hundred such pairs tracked down by researchers. And of course, identical twins, and we're talking about identical twin pairs here, are genetically absolutely the same. However, if they are reared in separate households, then their environments are completely different. So how similar are they? We can compare their similarities to identical twins who are reared in the same household. And the astonishing finding has consistently been that identical twins reared apart, and in some cases not even knowing of the existence of the co-twin, are no less similar to each other than identical twins who reared in the same household. Now, how can this be? You would think that the shared environment of a household would have a powerful effect on personality, on intelligence, on professional interests, that sort of thing. But it turns out that that is not the case. On the other hand, at the same time, it is not the case that identical twins, whether reared in the same household or whether separated at birth and reared apart, are absolutely identical. When it comes to personality traits, they're gregariousness, for example, or their shyness or their conscientiousness, all of these things appear to be about 50% heritable. And yet there is a 50% in the variation of these traits that is left up to the environment. Well, where does that environment come from? It is not the environment of the family. The environmental effect on traits of this kind, and now intelligence is a particular trait that tends to be more highly heritable, and it becomes more highly heritable as people get older, which may be something that's counterintuitive, and we can get into that later. But let's take, for example, the trait of conscientiousness. We find that the variation in this trait is governed pretty much 50% by genetics. The remaining 50%, in other words, is affected by environment. And yet, what we know from these twin studies is that the shared environment of the family is not what matters. What are these environmental effects? They seem to be chance circumstances, who you meet when you're growing up, whether or not you had inspiring teachers in school, different kinds of vacation experiences you might have had. These are one-off, random, non-systematic environmental effects that are very, very difficult to anticipate, control, or manipulate. And so to get back to what I was saying earlier about what this means for social theory, the importance of creating environments that will result in equality, it means that all of these efforts essentially are for naught. That within the broad bounds of general middle class or lower middle class to upper middle class households, your outcomes are going to be essentially the same, and to the extent that they are different and caused by environment, they're caused by chance, unsystematic factors that we simply cannot manipulate in an intelligent and consistent way. This really is, as I say, it's a nail in the coffin of the view that all of our differences are the result of environment, and that if we just have the right environmental interventions, the right kind of schooling, the right kind of supplemental programs for those who are not doing so well, we will all end up at the finish line together. This is not the case, absolutely not the case. And to the extent that our environments are similar, and increasingly, with compulsory education, with proper nutrition for people, our environments are, at the most basic level, becoming extremely similar. To the extent they are similar, the differences in results are going to increasingly reflect heredity. They're increasingly going to reflect DNA. This is something that I believe that the left will not accept, despite the evidence. The people who cling to this idea that environment is everything, those people are simply going to have to die off because they have staked their careers on environmental intervention, on programs of uplift, and it will be impossible for many of them to admit, well, I've been wrong all my life.
Yeah, indeed, that's what I was going to say. They've staked so much on this that their whole worldview is going to crumble. Or their whole paradigm, they're certainly all of their social prescriptions, the worldview that they promulgate, is just going to collapse, surely.
Yes, yes. And this is something that most people find simply intolerable. So they will cling to this environmental illusion for absolutely as long as possible. Now, one of the aspects of this that is particularly important is the extent to which by reflecting our own genetic propensities, we tend to create environments that encourage our own propensities. And I'll give you an example. In the case of identical twins separated at birth, there was a classic case. This is an utterly typical example. One woman ended up in a household that was full of books, and she became an avid reader and studied literature in university. Her co-twin ended up in a house with no books. Well, what did she do? She spent all of her spare time in the library. She borrowed books, brought them home into this house that had no books, and she ended up studying literature at university. So she created an environment that matched her propensities. The other twin ended up in an environment that matched her propensities, but the older we get, the more we become like our genetic selves because we end up creating environments that suit what it is we really are. And in young children, it is possible through intensive environmental pressure to make them into something that is not exactly what they would be if left to their own accord. There is a certain amount of environmental impact on such things as intelligence, personality, etc. But by the time people are 18, 19, 20, and certainly by the time they are 45, 50, 60 years old, they become much more genetically like their brothers and sisters, like their parents, because they have created environments. Once they have the autonomy to create environments that suit their own inclinations, then they become more like their genetic selves, because that is essentially how they are most comfortable. Now, one aspect of this that is very humbling for someone like me, who is a father, it's very humbling to all parents, is to realize that our children, even if they were reared in families entirely different from ours, completely different families, chances are they would turn out as they're going to turn out. As a father, I like to think that I'm doing the best by my children, doing all kinds of things that make them better people, certainly trying to mold them in directions that I would want them to go in. The fact is, they are simply becoming themselves. And one of the messages of this book is that parents and children, their relationship should never be one in which the parent is trying to be a carpenter building something or a gardener cultivating something. The parent is really, should have the attitude towards a child as he has towards a friend. This is someone with whose relationship you should enjoy. You don't try to change your friends. You accept them as they are. And your children, because they are 50% genetically you, they're going to be similar to you in many ways. They're going to have tendencies and preferences that are often very compatible with yours. But if you have a child who has no athletic inclination, you can try all you want. You can't make an athlete out of that child, and you're just going to frustrate everyone trying. Or if you think you want a child to be musical, and the child hasn't any musical talent, you cannot force a child to be musical or to be outgoing or any of these things. Now, of course, we can always try to instill a firm sense of right and wrong, and we think that we are accomplishing something doing this. The fact is, one's moral concepts, even one's religiosity, are very genetically, are something that is genetically very much part of how you're made up. Of all the aspects of personality, interestingly enough, the ones that have the most environmental influence tend to be political orientation and choice of religion. And these, in this case, the variation that is due to genetics is maybe 30 or 40%, as opposed to 50%, which is the case in most personality, in most personality traits. So environment does have an effect on politics, and it does have an effect on religion. But again, the extent to which this is something that is caused by what is known as shared environment, that is the environment that siblings share, household environment, it's very, very hard to pin down where these environmental effects come from. So again, very sobering news for parents who think we are somehow essential to the way our children turn out. We're not. They're going to turn out pretty much the way they are, because that's the way the DNA blueprint is going to affect itself in their own development.
How it's going to manifest is a very persistent force.
That's right.
What are the traits that are heritable? You've mentioned, obviously intelligence. We all know about that.
Yes.
Some of us still don't know about that one, but let's leave that aside. conscientiousness and religiosity. Yes. Well, yes. What other traits are largely heritable?
Practically any trait that you can think of. Psychological diseases, schizophrenia, things like depression, manic depressive disorder, whether or not someone, is shy and likes to read, or someone who has a good time going to parties, whatever you can think of as a personality measure, These things are very, very largely influenced by DNA. In fact, DNA is the largest influence. That's something that Plumman says over and over again. There are environmental effects, but as I said before, these environmental effects are not the ones that we would have expected. They're not the fact that you grew up in a house full of books or that you grew up around gregarious people. The environmental effects are random, haphazard things that happen individually, part of what's called the non-shared environment, the environment that you create for yourself. So once again, there's this powerful, powerful genetic direction in which you are going to go. And then there are other environmental effects that are very difficult to control or systematize, which means that all of this well-meaning uplift that society thinks that it owes all of the least productive, least successful people doesn't have anything like the effect that we have always thought that it did.
Of course, that also means that all of these middle-class white parents don't need to feel guilty about giving their kids an unfair advantage anymore by reading to them and so on.
That's right. That's right. And something else that Plowman goes into in very convincing detail. He talks about the differences in GSCE scores, because he's writing from a British point of view, between students who go to selective schools and people that go to just ordinary public schools. And he said, we have this notion that these selective schools are better schools because the students who attend them get better GSCE scores. Well, they get better GSCE scores because they've been selected on that basis to begin with. They're not necessarily any better schools at all. And if you factor out the genetic abilities that the selected students bring to these selective schools, the schools themselves have practically no effect at all. The effect is tiny.
But even if it did have an effect, that would count as the environment that the person creates for themselves, wouldn't it?
Not necessarily. Well, it's something that a parent could really try to shove a child into. The point that Plowman makes is, why spend tens of thousands of pounds on a private school when the actual quality of the instruction of the school doesn't have much effect on your child's performance?
The term would be grammar schools and comprehensive schools or non-selective schools.
Yes, yes. So what Robert Plowman is telling us is that it's up to you if you want to spend a pile of money sending your child to a grammar school. But the effect of the grammar school is really very, very small. That if you have a smart, motivated child, that smart, motivated child is going to get just as good GSCE scores going to a comprehensive school as that child would going to a grammar school. Again, all very sobering stuff. And you can imagine the people who run those schools are not going to welcome this kind of news. Plowman writes about some committee that goes around to visit schools, and they rate schools, and they try to tell you, give you some notion of how much better instruction you're going to get from a particular kind of school. He says that's all a waste of time. All you need to do is see who they're selecting. And, of course, it makes sense when you think about it. They're selecting the smartest people of all to get into their schools. And so it would be absolutely crazy if the students who go to those schools didn't get better grades and the people who are not selected. But if you're smart enough to get in but then go to a comprehensive school, you're not going to suffer very much from not going to having gone to one of these fancy gilt-edged schools.
It's a similar thing with, as you've spoken about often, that the racial disparities in education results. Because if you assume that that they should all be equal, roughly the same, you know, then obviously you then have to explain away the fact that they're not, and you have to go in the most ridiculous. You see this all over the place. I got into a conversation with a guy who was denying that men and women are biologically are innately different psychologically. and then they really tie themselves in knots coming up with ways in which baby boys and baby girls are treated differently straight out of the womb. So that's why they behave differently at a week old and so on. I mean, this is just utter insanity that is necessary in order to maintain something that, as you've said yourself, no person of average intelligence would believe. because they just wouldn't be able to do it. It takes high intelligence to believe such, to construct such elaborate delusions.
Yes, yes. And in, for me, it is easier to forgive people who maintain illusions about racial equivalence and equality than it is to forgive those who insist that the sexes are equivalent and essentially interchangeable, aside from just gross morphological differences. Because there are many people who've never had much experience living around Asians or Blacks or any other people of different race. But everybody has a mother. A lot of us have sisters. We have girlfriends. And to then, in spite of it all, in spite of all this experience, think that somehow men and women are absolutely the same in their sexual appetites, for example, or in their aggressiveness or their persistence or their ambitions, that they're exactly the same. Who can possibly believe this? But they really do, as you say. They build up these elaborate illusions, and they persist in believing them despite whatever the evidence is. I recall a case in which some advanced progressive couple had decided that they were going to rear their daughter and their son absolutely identically. And of course, they did not have anything like toy weapons, toy guns in the household. The boy, however, unlike the girl, would pick up a banana and hold it like a gun and go, pow, 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 pow. Didn't even have to have them. He naturally was drawn to something that even looked like a gun. And no matter how many trucks they wanted to give the little girl, she wanted to play with toys. She didn't want to play with the trucks. And people are always baffled when they try to, even environmentally, induce girls to be boys or boys to be girls, because it's just the way we're born. And that's just one of these spectacular idiocies to assume otherwise.
Well, and of course, the infamous case was it John Money, the Professor John Money, and I think the patient's name was David Reamer.
Yes.
I mean, people can look into that if they want. There's no need for us to go into here. It's the same point that we would make. It's really horrendous.
Oh, it was a criminal undertaking what they did to that poor guy.
Yeah.
But he ended up committing suicide, I believe.
Yeah. So did his brother, I think, ironically. Yes. It's terrible, terrible. But, to get back to the main issue. So I think one thing that is a persistently interesting question, not just for our circles, but more broadly, because the answer to this seems to evolve all the time, and so I'm interested in what you would say to it now. Basically, how heritable is intelligence? You know, if you were to go for a percentage or whatever.
It appears to be somewhere in the order of 50 to perhaps 60-65% heritable. And that is why identical twins are so similar to each other in intelligence. They are not identical. And sometimes they are so close that two different twins taking intelligence tests are going to get scores that are just like the same person taking a test on a different day. They just sort of bounce around the same average. But the point is not just that the variance in intelligence is somewhere between 50, 65, maybe some people estimate as high as 80% controlled by DNA. It's the remaining perhaps 20%, 35% that must be accounted for by environment. We just don't know how to deal with that. There's no way we know how to manipulate that in any consistent way.
Yeah, but on Wikipedia, it says 80%.
Well,
the last time I checked, it said 0.8%.
Well, good for them. 0.8. That is one of the most hotly contested things going on. And but one of the points of this book, and again, I really urge your readers your listeners to take a look at this this book called Blueprint. They have now found genetic correlations with various different personality traits, mental illnesses. Now, as it turns out, we had this idea that a few genes were going to perhaps be involved in intelligence. That's not the case. There are many, many, many genetic variants that contribute to intelligence, high or low. And so what they've done is they take entire human genomes
and they compare them for people who have high intelligence and low intelligence. And they find patterns in the genetic, in the DNA structure, that there are patterns that are consistent with high intelligence, patterns consistent with low intelligence. Now, we have no idea what the chemical pathways are whereby these different genes may be coding for different proteins or turning on proteins, turning off proteins that result in more efficient brains. All we know is that we can come up with a DNA profile, and we can take the DNA of a newborn child, and then we can have a very good sense of whether or not this person is going to be in the top decile of intelligence, second, third, fourth, fifth. We have something that is utterly unchanged. You can't practice this. You can't change this. It's not going to change as you get older. And we can have this not only for such things as intelligence, but for the likelihood to be schizophrenic, likelihood to have manic depressive disorder. All of these things are now matched by DNA profile. The DNA profiles do not give us the full variation. If, for example, it turns out that 60%, 80% of intelligence, the variation intelligence, is controlled by genes, we cannot get to the point where we've got anywhere near that that we can detect just by a DNA profile. We may have only 15% that we can match in this consistent way to a DNA profile. But that's absolutely the best thing we've got. It is something that is vastly better than knowing the intelligence of your parents, for example, or knowing the socioeconomic position of your parents. If you have this, and these DNA profiles are going to match more and more and more and more. The reason it took so long to arrive at actual DNA profiles for intelligence and these complex traits is because they involve so many different genes. It may be that there are thousands of different sites on the genome, which in very subtle and small ways push your intelligence this way or that way. And so in order to get to the bottom of these things, we have to have huge samples. It's only then that we begin to detect these patterns. And it was only after it became inexpensive to do full genome-wide analyses of individuals and compare them that these what are called polygenic scores came into being. There are a few defects in human beings that are attributable to one or two simple on-off switches in our genome. But complex things like personality, intelligence, these things are controlled by many, 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 many genes, and they all have small effects. For that reason, they've been hard to track down, but we're tracking down more and more and more of them all the time. Something else, though, that has turned up as a result of these genome-wide association tests, or GWA tests, as they call them, is the discovery that mental illness is not a discrete diagnosis. What you end up with is a spectrum for schizophrenia, for example. And those who are across the border and those who are close to the border, or those who are way across the border in the wrong way, it's all on a spectrum. In fact, the way Robert Plomin puts it, the abnormal is normal. It's just where you lie on a spectrum. And you have genes that are clearly affecting or appear to be affecting many different characteristics. The way they combine can result in a personality that is susceptible to manic depressive disorder or to schizophrenia. All of this is very interesting. And another point that he makes that I think is quite eye-opening is he says that it's not necessarily best to have a genome pattern that puts you at very, very low risk for schizophrenia or for being manic depressive. What you want is something in the middle, because what's at the opposite end of the spectrum? He says that, for example, if you are at the opposite end of the genetic spectrum from manic depression, it may be that you have very flat affect. You don't get excited by things. You don't get sad. You're just, you're sort of inert. And so you don't necessarily want the lowest likelihood to be manic depressive. You want to be somewhere in the middle where you do feel things, you do feel pleasure, you do feel pain, you're excited, you can be depressed by some things, but you're not at the other end where you're off the charts. So this book is really full of quite fascinating insights.
Yeah, it sounds like it has provided a new perspective or galvanized your own perspective, which, of course, for someone like you is surprising because you're so well-versed in this subject already.
Well, I would say that I have been following this research, and there's nothing in here that really surprises me. It's wonderful, though, to have all this information in one place. And it is true that the idea of something like schizophrenia being simply, or autism, for example, all of these simply being on a scale. I mean, we do talk about the autism, spectrum. That has become common when you speak of autism. But apparently the idea that you are on a spectrum is really going to be something inevitable for all conditions, all personalities, traits. It's all on a spectrum. And we have all of this large number of genetic variations and patterns that contribute in very small ways to it. It was new for me that all of our personality characteristics and defects can be put on a spectrum just like autism. But this information has been available in bits and pieces, but it's wonderful to have it all in one place. And it's also wonderful to have it explained in, I think, a very, very understandable way by a fellow who's been doing this research. He's a wonderful scientist, but he's also very good at explaining things in understandable ways. And I'm very glad that he doesn't pull any of his punches. He says, this may not be the way you want the world to work, but this is the way it is. And he also talks about the fact that people are going to be wanting to have designer babies, so to speak, if we can do a biological assessment based on a single cell, because every cell has the same genome except for the reproductive cells. Every cell's got the same DNA patterns. So if you have a fertilized egg, or if you do in vitro fertilization, do 20 fertilized eggs, it will become very easy to do an analysis of all these different eggs and then decide which ones you want to implant. And generally, people are happy to avoid implanting eggs that suffer from some kind of obvious genetic disease. But while you're at it, why not implant the egg that has gene patterns for high intelligence, for musical ability, maybe athletic ability, when those things are discoverable? And he says, look, this is going to happen. Prepare yourselves for it, rather than just wringing your hands and saying, oh, this is playing God, and we shouldn't do this. So I think in that respect as well, he's a very brave guy. Now, he doesn't say anything about racial differences or group differences, but anybody who looks into this, I am sure, I would bet the next 25 mortgage payments that when we look into these patterns, as they become better established patterns for intelligence, even for different forms of personality, they're going to be substantial racial differences.
Well, of course, that flows so logically.
Yes.
Because obviously any group of humans is going to have an average on some given trait, and then some other group of humans is going to have a different average simply because the individuals are different individuals. So therefore, if the groups are not only different but very divergent in terms of their where they evolved, the environment factors and so on, then of course the averages are going to be even more divergent, very divergent.
Yes,
so
yes.
I mean, it simply makes sense. There, in fact, as I've said many times, there is no reason why they would be the same. There is no reason for that at all. Like, they can only differ.
That's right. For years, I've been saying to people who insist that the average black and the average white are of equal intelligence, well, why would you think that? Well, what scrap of evidence do you have that this would be the case? Why would anyone think such a thing?
Evidence or rationale?
Yes, yes.
How do you explain it?
No, it doesn't make a bit of sense. And here in the United States, as you know, and I suspect the same is true in Britain, there's an enormous amount of effort and worry that goes into narrowing the achievement gap between blacks and whites in school performance, in performance on the job. And so all of this is, of course, foolishness. because you have different populations with different averages and different average abilities. And the something I always often like to point out is the difference between the highest performing whites, for example, and the lowest performing whites. That's greater than the average difference between whites and blacks. We don't care about that. Nobody is pouring an enormous amount of money into trying to ensure that all white people get exactly the same scores on their standardized tests. We are reconcile the fact that some people are smarter and going to do better than others. We have to simply reconcile ourselves to the facts that some races, on average, are going to do better than others. And this is not to say, of course, that every white person is going to do better than every black person. No, there are plenty of black people who are quite smart and going to do better than most whites. But the idea of trying to equalize performance, this thing to which Americans have been pouring an enormous amount of financial and emotional resources, banging their heads against this unyielding brick wall, this is utterly futile. And as soon as people start making this kind of DNA blueprint type of a racial comparison, eventually the evidence will just be simply irrefutable that we cannot expect equal outcomes, and all of these attempts to achieve it are just nuts.
Yeah. Well, wasn't there a video, maybe I'm remembering incorrectly, but I think that there was a video on the Amren channel by you maybe a year ago, or maybe 2 years, I think it was more recent, like a year ago, where you talked about 14 genetic factors or gene variants had been identified that were correlated with intelligence and were also racially distributed differently among the races. That's so there, right. That was, I think it was 14. Could you speak about that?
I don't remember the number specifically, but this was the result of a compilation of different studies by a fellow who is racially aware. And he put all this together in a way to show that, yes, so far we have identified a certain number of these gene variants that are associated with intelligence. Again, we do not know what the chemical pathways are. We don't know how this affects the way the brain works. All we know is that there is a strict correlation. Now, and when we find that these variants, the ones that are associated with high intelligence, the variants associated with low intelligence, when we look at the distribution in the different racial groups, we find exactly what we would expect. Asians have the better hand than whites by a small margin. Whites have the better hand by a larger margin compared to blacks. We just have been dealt different genetic hands. And the idea that the outcomes between blacks, whites, Asians, etc., are somehow the result of some pernicious and unfair environmental system or oppression is just nuts. It's just completely nuts. But this is something that, at least in the United States, well, I'm sure it's in Europe too, it's absolutely taboo to talk sense about these things.
Oh, yes. And of course, the effort to equalize is not only futile, it's also very damaging. Yes. in multiple ways, because and perhaps the most profound way is that it forces us all to live a delusion, to live a lie.
To me, the worst damage is done when we tell black people, yes, you're just as smart and hardworking as white people. The reason you are not running Fortune 500 companies, and the reason your household income is lower than that of whites is because of all those wicked white people. What better way could there be to teach black people to hate white people than constantly be telling them, yes, of course you're just as smart. There's absolutely no difference. Race is a delusion, but you're being held down by all of these evil people who want you to fail. Of course, white people don't want black people to fail. And the idea that our society is just seething with viciousness, or now that it's become so difficult to even imagine some white person who is getting up in the morning and deciding, how am I going to make life miserable for black people? There are no such people. So then the explanation is, well, it's unconscious racism. Or we're not even, it's systemic racism, it's institutional racism. It's unconscious and undeserved white privilege that lifts us up while black people are, you get one more preposterous explanation after another, so that you get, and it's the folly ends up being folly on stilts.
Yeah, but and at that point, this is why I say it's profound damage. At that point, what connection does the person still have with reality? And if they're prepared to, I mean it quite seriously, if they're prepared to get so mired in, if they have become so mired in that delusion, then I think that's going to affect their thinking in other ways as well.
But you know, it is remarkable. People who are otherwise intelligent, people who otherwise are pretty good at detecting patterns and drawing sensible conclusions from them, in this particular area, it's all of a sudden as if they've been taking stupid pills. They affect understanding about race, and you were describing earlier people who refuse to recognize the differences between men and women. Again, these are people who are certainly capable of recognizing the differences between automobiles, for example, or the late arrival time for airlines. You know, they could look at fine differences like that and make decisions. But when it comes to men and women, or when it comes to blacks and whites, there can be huge differences, and they refuse to recognize them. It's a selective kind of stupidity. It doesn't, and I always am amused by the fact that this does not lead to their buying houses in black neighborhoods, for example. It does not lead to them sending their children to schools that are full of black people. Here, they pretend that these differences don't exist, and yet, in their own lives, they certainly act as if they not only exist, but are very substantial and make a huge difference in how we live.
Mm, indeed. Is there anything else that you would like to say about Blueprint, the book?
Yes, read it.
Okay, excellent. Okay, well, shall we leave this one at that?
I think that'd be fine, yes.
Okay, excellent. Well, Jared Taylor, thank you for appearing on Millennial, and I hope that people do have a look at that at this book, because it seems to have excited you for sure.
Yes. It really has gathered all of this information into one place in a very accessible and persuasive way.
Excellent.